This is Pravda, Reel 2.
Now, Jaroslav Seifert, who at the end of his life now got the Nobel Prize, was one of these who were not only friendly but heroic. He came to visit us. There was another poet called Franta Halas. I mean, they were fantastic people, and their courage manifested itself in sort of a typically Czech protest of ignoring the Germans, ignoring the yellow stars, behaving like a normal life, which was more and more difficult every day. And I would say that three quarters of the village I lived in behaved in exactly the same way, ignoring Nazis.
You mentioned the lady whose son joined the Gestapo, Mrs. Palacheva. Was that type of collaboration very common in Czechoslovakia?
It must have been. It must have been not very common, that's a wrong word. I would say there must have been about 10% of people who will collaborate with any enemy for their own profits. And a shining example of this was a caretaker of the big house I lived in Prague, who was definitely in touch with Gestapo, which I didn't know about, but I was told about it after the war. But when the Russians marched in and took over, she immediately enlisted her help with the GPU. So she was watching again in the same door if somebody took a carpet out of the house or if somebody talked against the regime. And she would have been collaborating with Chinese, as we called. She would have gone yellow, you see. She would have collaborated with anybody who was in power. So this rebel you find everywhere. But in my own personal experience, I haven't met too many of them.
Do you think any of the Czechs collaborated for political reasons because they sympathized with Nazism?
Definitely not. Only for personal, short-lived profit. There wasn't any sympathy. They couldn't be, you see, because even our rabid patriots couldn't collaborate with the Germans because it was against the Czech nation. It's like if you were in a position where some sort of a fascistic regime in France wanted to overtake England, not even English fascists would sympathize because you don't want to be overtaken by France. So the more to the right you were, the more naturally you hated the German fascists. No, our Czech fascists couldn't possibly collaborate except, as I say, to get the house of a Jew or rob him of paintings, etc., etc. No, purely robbery.
Now, I interrupted your narrative with you being taken to Theresienstadt. What was the journey to Theresienstadt?
Well, it was horrible. It was horrible because suddenly it dawned on us that they really mean. I mean, we knew that transport was sent from other places, but being tucked in deep country, you know, it took longer. People from other places were sent there a year or 2 years even earlier. We were not allowed to travel with this yellow star. I couldn't go to Prague. I couldn't move from that village. So again, the informations were very, very slow to come, what was going in other places on. We knew that the letters were censored. And you don't want to bring other people into any danger, so you sort of shut up. You don't telephone because they were overheard. It was a small country under complete siege. And when they herded us up like cattle, I must say that some people were like vultures. Even in that village, there came a woman from neighborhood who said, well, now you're going away. I don't think you will need a tape recorder, or not the tape recorder, the taping machine, you know. You won't need this or that. because you're obviously not coming back. So it was a pretty cynical attitude. But again, she was an individual, and the multitude were terribly unhappy. We saw Czech gendarmes crying hot tears when they were heading us up, really crying, big, fat men. So they put us in a school where we didn't have any beds. We slept on the floor. But I was a terribly optimistic young woman. I wasn't really terrified or unhappy. I thought, it's the war, we shall survive, you know, they will be beaten. People must keep in mind one thing, to be imprisoned in peacetime, like some of the prisoners in other countries now, in Soviet Russia or Africa, who are living through torture during peacetime and seeing not the end of this, must be in a bigger moral despair than we were. Because we were hoping so fervently that it is only temporary and that we are strong and that we shall survive and perhaps even take vengeance on these scoundrels. So the mood wasn't altogether desperate. The older people, I remember vividly, said, "How can you be so cheerful? How can you joke?" Because they had a feeling this is the end of their lives. So they were really dejected and crying and giving up hope. But the young ones, not. When we came to, the ghetto, it's a very funny word for, we never had ghettos in Czechoslovakia. This was a fortress. This was a fortress built in time of Maria Theresia and her son, which was 18th century. It was a military post, outpost, surrounded by thick walls. It was rather handsome little place, and it was meant for 6,000 soldiers. In the time where aeroplanes did not exist, it was a very, very mighty place. There was one called Theresienstadt after Queen Maria Theresia, and the other was Josefov, equally. Later on, during the modern times, it was used like one of the many posts where the soldiers were billeted. Nothing special about it, nobody thought about it. When they packed 76,000 Czech Jews in a place where 6,000 soldiers should have been accommodated, plus few private houses, it became an ant heap. It was so squashed and squeezed. They moved the inhabitants out. Then they just put the Jews in. And we didn't understand what was going on. You see, we did not understand. The main thing was this complete lack of information, what they had in mind. And we had to go through with luggage. They said, pack whatever you want to pack. The more you pack, the happier. So some German people who were there, there were about 76,000 of Czech Jews and about 40,000 who were sent from Germany, and a little smothering of Austrian and Danish people. Because this ghetto was only one of many assembling places where later on they wanted to send the Jews to the extermination camps. Again, we didn't know. Again, perhaps even the Germans at that time didn't know exactly what they are going to do with it. Because the first aim was the robbery. And the second aim later on, I believe only in 44 or 43, was the decision what they call the final solution. Build factories of death, build the gas chambers, and exterminate every single Jew in the world or in Europe. I don't think by that time when we came in 42, it was clear. It was certainly not known to us. So we thought, We shall survive again, you know, squashed like vermin, but so what? We shall endure it like sitting in prison, and by the end of the war we shall be released.
Was the congestion terrible?
Absolutely ghastly. I was sleeping in an average-sized room with 16 people. They built planks like in prison, but you have, I suppose, I don't know how many planks are in prison in England. I suppose two, no? Like in a cabin on
bulks.
A ship. Bulks, yes. Well, we had fives. So if you were climbing up, you know. And people tried desperately to make it as clean and as decent as possible. So you washed a little bit of in front of your bunk. And it was overrun by vermin very soon because the Germans must have sent some sort of old blankets or something which brought this vermin. I can't understand why it would be, because I never saw so much vermin in my life. And I tell you a psychological story which made me laugh. We laughed a lot. We laughed a lot because it's the best cure to take this absurd sin. There was a woman in a bunk above me. And one nice day she said, "I can't understand, Hannah, how you can kill fleas. It's so horrible. I couldn't do it." And she caught a flea and she used to throw these fleas down at me. Sort of getting rid of this creature, almost a Buddhist attitude. That's
so
all.
You could kill them.
So I could kill them. you know, the individual experiences of each of us were really black comedy, because people being squashed in such proximity, you know them terribly well.
Did you have lice?
Much later on, not in Terezin. In Terezin, the Germans were terrified of typhus. What paratyphus was prevalent, you know. We didn't call it by that name, but gastroenteritis was absolutely in every barrack. But the rest, the Germans knew that bugs don't recognize who is Jewish and who is not. And they were very anxious that the people who were doctors who were sent to Terezin took a lot of medicine with them. They allowed even operations in the barracks. So the concentration of medical care in that ghetto was fantastic. We had about one doctor for 10 people, you know. And we had dentists, and we had professors of philosophy, and we had... This is the reason why certain people, remembering Terezin, in spite of this dirt and abnormal circumstances and fear later on of the transports further on to Poland, have rather cheerful memories. Because there were mostly people of middle class, well-educated, gentle nature. Imagine that in these years in Terezin, there wasn't one single murder. Can you imagine? These thousands and thousands of people pressed together, nobody ever murdered anybody, which I think is a miracle. There were little quarrels, but not a murder, not one single one. And I know that in other camps, like after the war, when people were telling me about the Ukrainian soldiers' camps, you know, prisoners of war, there were many murders, there was a lot of violence and a lot of animosity. But in Terezin, no. There was very little thieving, very, very little. It was almost a sort of a forced kibbutz. You know, people understood each other and people were very brotherly. And what sustained us was culture. It was, I always have to laugh at people who said it's a luxury, or what they do in England, say our patrons. That's a ridiculous word. patrons, about people who buy a ticket for the show, you know. What kind of patrons? They are giving we are giving sustenance to them, not they to us. I mean, how can £5 give you mental sustenance? And we had shows almost every night, I being a professional actress, plus a lot of very gifted amateur actors, and some fabulous German actors from the Volkstheater in Berlin, were giving shows in the attics and in the cellars through all these 2 years. I spent almost 3 years. I spent in Theresienstadt 2 years, from 40 to 44. And we had, from the other inhabitants who were chased away from the Czechs, we had 4 pianos in Theresien. And only real professional virtuosi were allowed to play these pianos. And there was there are innumerable stories. I don't think we have time to tell you about the culture of Theresien. It was an essence of talent from every walk of life. There were painters, there were musicians, there were conductors who conducted opera. The Bartok Bride was done naturally without costumes. There were singing choirs. You could listen to lectures about history of art, about physics, about mathematics. Certainly our intellectual life was more intense than ever before. And we were given smuggled place. You know, the question, where did he get the place? Because we certainly didn't take in our luggage theater place. Later on, I heard how it came that we had quite a lot of plays there, like Gogol and Čapek, and we had even Twelfth Night by Shakespeare there. It was smuggled from National Theatre in Prague through the gendarmes. They were obviously paid to smuggle these things in. So we had books, we had poetry, we had evenings of poetry. And all these worked miracles for the morale of people, I assure you. Even when they are hungry, I mean, I remember vividly after one show, we played Faust by Goethe, and people were sitting with closed eyes, obviously seeing it in their mind in a big theater. And afterwards, when we finished, they came with pieces of margarine and forcing it on us, bread and margarine, and we didn't want to take it naturally. And they said, please, please take it, because you gave us illusion of the free world and all the philosophy and all the help we need. So I assure you, if anybody is ever in a lurch, poetry, theater, music, it's the only answer how to survive.
Was there any anti-Nazi element ever in the plays?
The Nazis were behaving like a different sort of animals. They fenced us in. They left the village green in Theresien for the Kommandatur, for the house of the commandants. And from time to time they threw the officers in the barracks to look if the Jews are not smoking cigarettes or if they haven't got anything smuggled in. And we had curfew. And they were dragging people who, for example, draw the scenes of Theresien. You know, it was not permitted to paint. And of course, people wanted to document. We couldn't have any photographs, so three or four painters secretly painted the scenes of the emaciated old people and the queues for the soups and all the rather harrowing scenes. For example, they were distributing bread on hearses, you know, and it was an absurd and comical sight to see a hearse full of loaves of bread, which was atrocious, being pulled by people and pushed by people all around Theresien. Now, if a painter painted that, he was dragged out of Terezin to so-called small prison, which was another building next to the ghetto, where he was beaten to death. I remember one, Mr. Fritta, who was butchered like this because they found paintings, which he was not allowed to do.
So the Nazis were sensitive about
the painting? Nazis were terrified of documentation, absolutely terrified. And they had a visit of a Red Cross in 1943. And they were not lazy to erect a, what you would call a film set. They constructed a coffee house with inscription. They put the best looking people sitting by the tables, drinking coffee, which wasn't coffee, but never mind. They printed local Theresienstadt money, a sort of stage money. And they directed this charade, this Potemkin's tragic charade, with few volunteers, and let the small group of the Red Cross in and said, look, Hitler is keeping Jews in rather nice surrounding. Our soldiers are dying, fighting for Germany, and here the Jews are sitting in peace, drinking coffee, paying paper money in a typical coffee house. And they would not allow, certainly, the commission to see anything else except this one corner, you see. I'm laughing, but it was a travesty. And these, I don't know what the Red Cross thought about it, but certainly they came back with the impression that it was not an extermination camp, that it was a bad, rather transitory thing, where it wasn't so horrible to survive the war. I don't know if they reported it, if they saw through this charade or not, but I know it was made. They made a special film about how the Führer is treating mildly the nasty Jews.
Was it a horrible place to be in?
Theresienstadt? Certainly, because people left and right from you were dying of hunger. You see, the older people could not stand it. And some of the German Jews, especially the old ladies, were told they are going to a spa. They brought with them evening dresses. They brought evening shoes. And I heard one of these rather stupid women, when we were queuing to go to the lavatory, because there were very few lavatories, you had to queue for a long time and take your dirty water with you, etc. And I overheard her saying, now look, if only our Führer, Hitler, would see how the Czechs are treating us, he wouldn't believe it. She was living under the illusion that the cruelty and the nastiness of this camp was made by Czechs. So this is the depth of uninformed opinion.
How did the Germans and the Czechs in Theresienstadt get on with each other?
Very well. But very, very separate. You see, the language was... I wouldn't say the language was the barrier, because we had compulsory German and French in school. I mean, practically every Czech could speak a bit of German. We were surrounded by Germany before the war. But they were not mixing very much. The Czechs stuck to the Czechs in a sort of a brotherly support, I would say. And the older generation and the young generation. What was the main... I mean, the Germans wanted, as they always want, the prisoners to have some sort of a circle of people who would rule over the other circle of people, you see, to spare them the troubles. And there was a committee of very clever men who did everything they could. For example, the children got the best food for survival. It wasn't equally distributed. You know, the children had all the milk they could get, and the children were looked in special cleaner piece of the buildings, and they were even exercising them. And as they had no schools, I was teaching a group of children. No, everybody was teaching everybody, because everybody was thinking about the future. So there was a children opera organized, you know, just to keep going, keep going. And again, with the aim of surviving the war. But then the most terrible time started. People were dying. People were dying of malnutrition. People were dying of despair. People were dying of tuberculosis, because sleeping in one place, you know, I'm surprised that I didn't get it, because at least 5-6 women in the one room I slept in were tuberculosis. What was interesting medically, I don't know if ever anybody did research into it, because we were so very undernourished and we had no meat, there wasn't a single diagnosed case of new cancer. Cancer vanished, but tuberculosis flourished. So there is something to it, which a doctor should look into it. I knew a doctor who did not return from Auschwitz, who said, "Hannah, when I come back from the war, I'm going to sit down and write a paper that cancer is a matter of diet." You know, this very, very mean diet. This is why in the Third World War they probably haven't got cancer.
Did you fall sick yourself in Theresienstadt?
What?
Did you fall sick yourself in
Theresienstadt? Yes, yes. I got asthma. I got asthma because I couldn't sleep on the straw mattresses. I mean, couldn't. I had to. There was no other mattress and no other pillows. And I had terrible attacks of asthma, waking up all the 16 people in my room, which they didn't like. And I got the usual gastroenteritis, which everybody had. And apart from it, not. No, I was quite a healthy woman.